You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
The success of a media platform, any media platform, be it OTT like Netflix, be it a television channel or a podcast like Money Control, is the amount of influence it wields on consumption patterns. How much do they want to come back? That someone as great as Steven Spielberg is now waging the war for cinema's soul by treating Netflix like an unworthy adversary that does not deserve to compete for cinematic honors should tell us something about the kind of splash that Netflix has made. Why should the great Spielberg think Netflix is corroding the sacredness of big screen concept entertainment? Well, that is possibly one reason why. On the 18th of January 2019, Paste, an American monthly music and entertainment digital magazine, listed out some of the most influential Netflix originals that have shifted our idea about what entertainment really means. For now, it is all about being, yes, atypical. The piece said, and I quote, "The fact that we can even make a list of the best Netflix original series is kind of amazing." 6 years ago, the now dominant streaming platform was best known as the company that put blockbusters out of business. House of Cards not only changed all that, it also changed the way TV is consumed, introducing the now popular binge-watching model. History is made by forward-thinking companies, and Netflix, let's be honest, is making history. Unquote. But is Netflix making profit? Now, that is a difficult question to answer, not least because the platform is famously cagey about releasing its viewership numbers. But we do know that Netflix has about 137 million users worldwide as of October 2018, and that profits in the October quarter last year reached $403 million, with revenues growing 34% to $4 billion. But we also know that the company plans on investing $8 billion in original content. On this edition of Digging Deeper with Money Control, we will try and answer what lies in the future of a platform that has personalized entertainment and has inspired memes about cats, dogs, and yes, even pet pigs watching The Crown with their humans on a couch next to takeout boxes. The story about what lies ahead for a company that forever changed the meaning of the word chill is what I, Rakesh Sharma, bring to you on this edition of Digging Deeper with Money Control.
The Deep Dive podcast series,
The Future of Netflix.
But first, let's start with the Paste story, which mentions the binge staples on Netflix, including The Crown, Sense8, ideated in part by the Matrix creators, Margaret Atwood's historical novel adaptation of Alias Grace, the comedy Atypical, addictive crime drama Narcos, prison dramedy Orange is the New Black, the unpredictable horror of Stranger Things, as well as The Haunting of Hill House, the beloved Lemony Snicket classic A Series of Unfortunate Events, refreshingly cerebral food shows like Ugly Delicious or crowd favorite Chef's Table, the politically charged and enlightening Dear White People, the brave gaze of Queer Eye, and of course, House of Cards, and many, many more. The point being, the questions asked, the issues raised, the boxes checked, and the genres covered within the span of these beloved shows make big screen entertainment look tepid and almost one-dimensional in its constant hunger to appease what is often the lowest common denominator. But that is also only half of the story. While Netflix may have broken new ground in terms of storytelling, the old staples are still the most streamed shows on the platform, according to data from analytics firm Jumpshot. The Office, that is the US version, is by far the most streamed show on Netflix, accounting for more than 7% of all views, followed by Friends at 4.13%, Parks and Recreation at 2.34%. Grey's Anatomy, New Girl, Supernatural, That 70s Show, Criminal Minds, NCIS, and Arrested Development are the top 10 most streamed shows on Netflix. With the exception of the divine Arrested Development, new seasons of which Netflix is bringing out, the rest of the shows on that top 10 list are all owned by Disney, Fox, WarnerMedia, and NBC Universal. Enjoy these while you can, as more than half of the 50 most popular shows on Netflix are owned by companies planning to launch their own streaming services. Disney, the acquisition of the entertainment parts of Fox by Disney, is to be completed on the 20th of March. The other streaming services in play, NBCU and Warner Media, they're all coming out with their own streaming services. The top 50 Netflix shows account for 42% of all Netflix views, according to Jumpshot. Of course, it's not necessary that these shows will vanish from Netflix once these streaming services are in place, but Netflix will have to shell out more and more money to keep them on. For example, Netflix shelled out almost $100 million for exclusive rights through 2019 to Friends, a show that has clearly had its day, its week, its month, and even its years for 25 years now. But let's also go back to why Steven Spielberg is almost waging a war on Netflix, one that many people say he's going to lose. Film critic Owen Gleiberman wrote in industry magazine Variety a few days ago about what appears to be the war of the worlds between the cinematic planet that the likes of Spielberg inhabit and the one that Netflix has created out of, well, nothing except the desire to offer options to jaded content seekers. That is mostly all of us. The piece begins with the Netflix statement, which said, "We love cinema," in response to Steven Spielberg's reported effort to push for new guidelines regarding the eligibility of movies to compete in the Academy Awards. So what exactly is Spielberg's beef with Netflix? According to the piece, Spielberg, who is a member of the Academy's Board of Governors, has yet to publicly articulate any proposal against Netflix, but based on statements like, and I quote, "Once you commit to a television format, you're a TV movie and should be eligible for the Emmys, not the Oscars," unquote. And on the fact that Netflix has already proved its willingness to exhibit an Oscar contender in more than a few movie theaters, it seems likely that Spielberg would push for the Academy to require something like a 3-month window between a film's theatrical release and its availability on streaming services. As the writer goes on to say, any movie that's streamed before that wouldn't be eligible for the Oscars. The potential guidelines would be aimed directly at Netflix with its short to non-existent window. But is that fair to a company that loves cinema? We no longer have to watch a movie, even a great one, in a movie theater. That hasn't been necessary for close to 70 years. Before streaming, we had DVDs, and before DVDs, we had VHS, and before VHS, we had the Sunday night movie or the 4:30 matinee. And before any of that, you could watch The Late Show on television any night of the week. So watching a movie at home and chilling with it is neither a big deal nor a new thing. But as the piece helpfully points out, and I reproduce verbatim, watching a movie at home the day it comes out is very new. Taken to its logical extreme, or even halfway there, it undermines the basic economic engine that has driven Hollywood for the last 100 or so years that Hollywood has been in existence. Put in practical and specific terms. Now, if you knew this weekend that you could watch Captain Marvel in your living room just 2 weeks from now for a charge of, let's say, $75, would you go out and see it in a movie theater, or would you wait to see it at home? Different people will obviously have different responses, and everyone can craft their own example. Would you have waited to see A Star Is Born, or Sorry to Bother You, or The Favorite, or Bumblebee, or In India? Would you wait to see Kalank instead of going first day, first show, or in a movie theater in a few days of its release? Based on their own viewing habits and priorities, people have different answers. But it is obvious, when you think about it, where all this goes. It's potentially the biggest paradigm shift in movies since the introduction of VHS, and perhaps even bigger. And if you remember right, after acquiring the distribution rights for it, Netflix didn't merely give Roma a token release. The film actually played in more than 100 independent theaters and was kept there for months, with Netflix actually paying the theaters for the privilege of doing so. And Roma wasn't even made by Netflix. So the signs are all there that from content creation for its own platform, now Netflix is spreading its area of influence by backing ideas that profit-obsessed studios probably won't. I can't imagine many big-name studios in Hollywood taking on the languid, majestic, and almost nothing happens there sort of film like Roma, and Netflix did it. Paste magazine, of course, went on to differ a little bit and said, "The fact that Netflix took on Roma in the first place has inspired many voices in the media to parrot the line that they make the movies the big studios now won't." I can't send us into an alternate universe to prove this, but I persist in thinking that if Netflix had never existed, an Oscar-winning director named Alfonso Cuarón would still have made Roma, and it would still have been an awarding phenomenon. Now, I somewhat disagree with it, because a film like Roma would have remained a festival circuit favorite, won the prize in Cannes or Berlin or Venice, and even been nominated for a Best Foreign Film Oscar. But would the millions of people that have now watched Roma and enjoyed the magnificence of it have done so? I think unlikely. So it would be naive to believe that the association with Netflix has not benefited Roma. And Netflix is not just looking to become the cheerleader of brave new cinematic voices, but also the purveyor of the definitive blockbuster. Netflix is making Martin Scorsese's The Irishman at a cost of at least $125 million. And this is bringing back Pacino and De Niro. In 2019, That is a stratospheric budget, $125 million for a movie that isn't some CGI-driven fantasy tentpole. And the magic of that number, so bandied about in discussions of The Irishman, has become its own form of advertising. What company in the real world would spend $125 million to back one gangster epic, which is the supreme labor of love of Martin Scorsese? The answer is almost axiomatic. A company that loves cinema. Which company said that recently? Netflix. The point is, regardless of what Spielberg believes or not believes, the battle is not between big ticket entertainment and content consumption in the comfort of your own home, at least not for the consumer. She will still watch Black Panther and Wonder Woman on the big screen and catch them again on her favorite OTT platform. We are now inhabiting a space where entertainment cannot mean just one thing. It is time for expansion of the idea of entertainment and storytelling. And big studios have realized just that and are creating their own streaming platforms, while vendors like Netflix are making tentative inroads into the studio system. So the big studios have understood what appeal Netflix has, and Netflix has understood what the appeal of the big theater is. What used to be a conflict of thought, at least in terms of what entertainment should constitute, now seems to be a two-way traffic, where both these parties are trying to dip their feet into the other's pools. As the piece went on to say, Steven Spielberg's attempt to try to erect a fence between what Netflix does, which is release movies via streaming and a few times a year sprinkle them into theaters, and what the Academy does, which is to recognize movies that play to audiences in theaters as movies, has been attacked. This fence between Netflix and what the Academy does, this fence has been attacked by some members of the Academy, and notably by scores of online film fans who are probably under 40, as the last gasp of an archaic way of seeing things. Netflix, however, further elucidated its contrarian stand by stating that it thrives on providing access for people who can't always afford or live in towns without theaters, letting everyone everywhere enjoy releases at the same time, giving filmmakers more ways to share art. That's what Netflix said. As the writer points out, the statement asked implicitly is, are you against these things? And the online reaction against Spielberg has basically treated him as if he was. Now, what the online debate has done is it has made this a moralistic debate. Now, when you say you're against the Netflix model, what are you trying to say? It's asking us. Are you saying that people everywhere shouldn't enjoy the same things as you do at the same time? Are you suggesting that somehow you are better than them in that you can go to the theaters, whereas they have to wait for a lot longer to see the same thing? Are you saying you're morally against everybody getting the same entertainment at the same time? Now, the online reaction to Spielberg saying there should be a fence between Netflix and what the Academy does makes it seem like Spielberg is against that egalitarian idea of seeing things at the same time. In a subtextual way, identity politics have entered the fray. Spielberg is his old white male trying to hang on to his entitled way of doing things, while Netflix, representing speed, access, democratization, a multiplicity of voices, is the force of techno-woke rebellion, opening up the world to greater possibilities. And just as Netflix has used a work of art like Roma as a one-film signifier of the company's purity of intent, many observers have bought into the message of the advertising, which is, do we want an Academy that disqualifies Roma from competing in the Oscars but rolls out the red carpet for a studio film that plays by the rules yet isn't nearly as good? The Netflix versus Spielberg battle has become, in mythical terms, a case of the rebel disruptor versus the man. And these days, who wants to be on the side of the man? The disruptor has all the street cred. Well, we think the man doth protest too much. But coming back to the central question, how is Netflix doing in terms of profits? The company wants to prove that it loves cinema. That much we've understood. Because by doing so, it can woo the filmmakers, the audiences. It needs to become an industry unto itself. It can woo them enough to remake cinema as we know it. And if it turns out that the vision of what cinema looks like or what cinema is after it gets remade doesn't happen to involve movie theaters, then so be it. It'll hardly matter to Netflix because Netflix will already own your viewing habits. And what is the most important thing any media platform can do? Own your habits. Whether that's cinema or not, it's one hell of a business plan. But as Paste magazine asked, is the technology of streaming now going to redefine what movies are? Because if a movie just streams, then what makes it a movie? Why not allow hundreds of films that are made for television to qualify for the Oscars? The writer said, and I quote, in the end, this battle is merely a preview of the larger streaming war to come. The one about how long all movies, and not just Netflix movies, will get to play in theaters before they're available at home. Because if that model genuinely changes with the backing of the major studios and the window shrinks down to a month or 2 weeks, then all bets are off. Netflix now stands like a monolith. But with that potential change looming, it could look like one more toothpick in the war for cinema's future. Netflix, however, has already moved on to the next big thing. That is towards an interactive future. Whether Netflix is able to challenge the entrenched studio system of movie making or is going to join it is not yet entirely clear, although we know there are inroads either way. But we do know where it wants to go next, towards more interactive shows after the success of Black Mirror Bandersnatch. Shannon Liao of The Verge reported that Netflix plans to make more interactive TV shows after Black Mirror Bandersnatch, the choose-your-own-adventure-style program, found international success. Netflix product vice president Todd Yellen said in Mumbai at a keynote presentation, and I quote, "It's a huge hit here in India and it's a huge hit around the world. And we realized, wow, interactive storytelling is something we want to bet more on. We're doubling down on that. So expect over the next year or two to see more interactive storytelling. It won't necessarily be science fiction, or it won't necessarily be dark. It could be a wacky comedy. It could be a romance where the audience gets to choose should she go out with him or him or him." Unquote. The piece reports that Yellen also emphasized that Netflix would make far more Indian content, doubling content production every year exponentially. He pointed to the success of the Netflix original Indian series Sacred Games, about a cop chasing down a crime overlord. Yellen said, on average, 2 out of 3 viewers of Sacred Games lived outside of India, demonstrating how culturally specific shows could still find global appeal. So the strategy is not just about creating more shows with already popular formats, but to make stuff more contextual, multilingual, and relatable. The piece informs us that to make more global hits, Netflix is also going to bring its original content to more dubbed languages. The bleak superhero series Umbrella Academy in particular is currently available in 25 languages. By next year, that number is going to be 30, according to Todd Yellen. All said and done, Netflix, when it comes to streaming services, still has the first mover advantage. On the 11th of March, writer Anthony D'Alessandro wrote in Deadline that when it comes to streaming, it is still a fertile land, but Netflix does have the advantage of being first to the front line. The piece quotes Netflix VP of original content, Cindy Holland, who recently said that on-demand television is in its very early stages and there's many opportunities for other companies to be successful as well. The piece informs that while neither Disney nor Warner Media's streaming service was specifically mentioned, Holland said that Netflix is leading the way in the on-demand television revolution. The companies that stay rooted in historical distribution models, for example, mainly television, they'll find themselves quite challenged. About rising Silicon Valley competitors in the streaming space, that is Facebook and Google, Holland said, and I quote, "We are different from the large tech companies. They are uncurated platforms. We are a paid subscription service. Our first priority is to entertain the members in our worlds, and if we don't do that, we won't continue to thrive in our world." As the piece points out, while traditional TV networks are tethered to ratings due to advertisers, and Netflix doesn't have to necessarily worry about that, the streamer decides what works based on their internal metrics of audience tastes and the projections they make of it. Holland explained programming decisions like this. Netflix sizes up the audience and how much to invest. If that audience doesn't show up to that level, what is the reason to continue to invest as they had hoped? Holland went on to say, and I quote, "If there's critical acclaim, that's important to us. We're about stretching investment dollars as far as we can, making good investments of our members' money," unquote. According to the piece, by the first 28 days, the streaming giant has a good idea if they've reached their viewership objectives for a particular series. Netflix viewership data also helps the streamer spot the white areas where there might be an unseen opportunity for content. Speaking of viewership data, the piece reveals that most subscribers watch the platform on their TVs over mobile phones, though the latter is also growing, that is watching on mobile phones. I am certainly guilty of that. Average members watch 2 hours a day, with weekends and holiday viewing being higher than weekdays, as that's when audiences have more time. Now, being involved in the DVD business early on gave Netflix some insight into the eclectic tastes of its members, according to Holland, and that type of data insight enabled Netflix to provide content for every audience, not just one. Deadline quoted Holland again, and I quote, "When we went into original content, we could offer a narrow set of titles for a specific demographic, but our business was much deeper," unquote. The key, opines the writer, was creating title brands and a personalization for subscribers so they could find the content they wanted to watch. In the piece, Holland also described the early benchmarks for Netflix. House of Cards was a series meant to define what Netflix would be, that subscribers could see premium content as good as that on pay TV. Transforming from a DVD rent-by-mail business, which was Netflix, to what Netflix is today, Holland said the question was how to grow the DVD business, to then grow to some form on the internet. That was the simple plan of the company. And no, the company did not have an original content strategy when they commissioned House of Cards. But as the piece asks in conclusion, will the success of original content at Netflix stop other networks from selling to them? Holland says, and I quote, "We thought they probably would, or that they'd allocate for their own services," unquote. And that is precisely what is happening now. And that is also the next challenge for Netflix. It is now not only a visible contender in the cinematic space, despite the disapproval of giants like Spielberg, but television networks now may think twice before giving them their hit shows, or charge way more than they would have earlier, or bring out their own streaming services, which stand in stark competition to where Netflix is right now. So the days ahead for Netflix may be exciting, but they're also mired in the kind of challenges that it may not have foreseen. And speaking of just that, everyone wants to create the next Netflix. In December 2018, Nicole Laporte wrote on Fast Company that the biggest proof of being a serious media company that totally gets the future is to announce a streaming service. From the newly formed Warner Media to Jeffrey Katzenberg's Quibi, etc., etc., everyone is throwing their hat in the ring, vowing to create the next Netflix. Nicole said, and I quote, "Why wouldn't they? Linear TV watching remains on a steady downhill incline. Even my mother knows what Netflix is and has become one of the 137 million people to sign up for the app. Anyone under the age of 18 spends most of their time on mobile devices. In this environment, it's not all that hard to drum up a couple of hundred million, or if you're Katzenberg, $1 billion, just by saying the words streaming platform." As the piece informs, Disney announced in the August of 2017 that it was pulling its content off Netflix in 2019 and launching a new entertainment app that would be built by BAMTech, in which Disney is a majority stakeholder. Now, of course, Disney is also buying the entertainment aspects of Fox. Now, that'll be integrated into this app as well. It wasn't until November 2018 that the service was given a name. It's called Disney Plus, and a few more contours to round out the picture. Content would be divided by brand, like Marvel, Disney, Pixar, Nat Geo, Star Wars, etc., and have exclusive movies and TV shows, including a new Star Wars series starring Diego Luna as rebel spy Cassian Andor, following his adventures leading up to Rogue One, a Star Wars story. So there is the chunk of Star Wars fans that may already be attracted to Disney Plus. The piece also goes on to say that Warner Media's new app may be coming together more quickly. The company has only existed, after all, since June 2018, when AT&T acquired Time Warner and then birthed Warner Media. The fruition of some of these plans is, however, slower than anticipated, with AT&T going only so far as having a plan to have a plan. Quoting from Nicole's piece, "Since being announced last summer, all we know at this point is that it will be a three-tiered service, not unlike AT&T's data plans. Content will come from HBO, Time Warner, and Turner," which anyone could have guessed. Turner executive Kevin Reilly will be heading the content strategy, and Friends, one of the crown jewels in the Warner Media library, will not be exclusive to the service at launch. Now, that's good news for Netflix. If it is exclusive to Warner Media, one of the most streamed shows and one of the most beloved shows on the planet will be sitting on just one platform. But if it is syndicated to other platforms, Warner Media could still make the money. Like I said, $100 million is what Netflix had to spend to get streaming rights for Friends for just 1 year. That is 2019. Then there is Quibi, which is Katzenberg's billion-dollar short-form mobile platform, which promises to have 5,000 episodes of quick bite content in the year after its launch next year, even though at this point it's not fully staffed. Not to mention Apple, which is sinking another $1 billion into a slate of high-profile press releases announcing deals with A24, as well as stars like Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston. Like I said, if something works, the Hollywood model has always been make more of it and get everybody else to do the same thing and make the competition juicier, but also in the process take the novelty off the whole exercise. But then again, if streaming is the way we will end up consuming entertainment in the 21st century, I guess the more options there are, the better it is for you and I. There are, of course, some basic questions that remain unanswered. How much will any of these services cost? What will be exclusive to these services and when will it appear on them? How much content will actually be offered at launch? Who knows? Those are late 2019 problems. What seems to have mattered most in 2018 was staking out ground in the increasingly crowded streaming universe and stating your intent not to be left behind in the digital revolution. And Netflix is already ahead in the game, first mover advantage, and as the piece says, it has begun directing its resources not just to big budget TV shows, but at the people who make them. after Netflix started this process back in 2017 with its $150 million overall deal with Grey's Anatomy and Scandal creator Shonda Rhimes, the streamer has followed suit this year with a $300 million deal for Glee and American Horror Story showrunner Ryan Murphy and a $100 million pact with Kenya Barish, the mind behind Blackish on ABC. With that, a talent arms race was underway with even non-household name writers getting fat overall deals. Warner Brothers signed Jessica Jones writer Melissa Rosenberg with an 8-figure deal. Marty Noxon, who created HBO's Sharp Objects as well as Unreal, an extraordinary show, and written on a number of big shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Mad Men, and Glee, also got similar treatment from Netflix. Netflix's motivation is to pad itself with brand name talent, who will attract brand name talent, who will in turn, theoretically at least, woo subscribers. Ultimately, that's the company's only real mission and business. Get eyeballs. It's also a way to deal blows to traditional media houses and weaken its competitors as Netflix evolves into its own television network. Rhimes and Barris were two of ABC's biggest showrunners, and it's not entirely coincidental that the Shonda Rhimes deal was announced just weeks after ABC's parent company Disney said that it would be pulling its content off Netflix in 2019 in order to keep it for Disney+. The Ryan Murphy deal came 2 months after Disney agreed to acquire Fox, which has been consistently Ryan Murphy's home base. American Horror Story is on Fox. Glee was on Fox. In conclusion, the question for 2019 is this: how much longer can this extravagance continue? Netflix is operating on borrowed cash, after all. At what point does spending on big names become a liability, or at least an incredibly risky game, especially given that at this point, most people are tuning into the service to watch Rhimes' old shows like Grey's Anatomy. The headlines generated by the deals have certainly captured the media's attention, but will the actual shows also capture the attention? The question is that when Disney has its own platform, all the ABC shows will go on it. Shonda Rhimes' Scandal or How to Get Away with Murder or Grey's Anatomy is probably going to be on Disney+. Will the new shows that Shonda Rhimes is likely to make for Netflix attract the same attention? Netflix certainly hopes that getting the big names will make sure that the audience will also follow along. But as of now, the watching model has always been that you go and watch the old favorites. How hard it is to create new favorites is something anybody who has ever done any content creation knows. Trust me, I know. But will this be a similar uphill task for Netflix as well? Let's also not forget that there are other big players in the space. And today we are only concentrating on Netflix, but there is Amazon Prime. The show Marvelous Mrs. Maisel of Amazon took home 8 Emmys last year, including Best Comedy, and has a wide array of quality shows, including Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan with John Krasinski, the adaptation of the popular Gimlet podcast Homecoming, which turned into a show with Julia Roberts, the drama series A Very English Scandal with Hugh Grant and Ben Whishaw, which ended up winning awards. But the piece also asks us the question that finally shows us to what extent Netflix has dominated the content space with disruptive strategies across the years. It went on to ask, and I quote, "Is the company that has always prided itself on being disruptor numero uno begun adopting some of the old Hollywood practices that it is desperately trying to use up? Is Netflix indeed a tech disruptor or a Hollywood sheep dressed in a disruptor's clothing?" Now, these kinds of questions are always asked only when a company has grown beyond our idea of what it was supposed to be. And Netflix has certainly transcended its own brief. But thankfully, what has remained constant is its ability to engage newer audiences with stories that challenge notions of the old and the new. And that perhaps is the bottom line, that as long as Netflix can surprise us, it may still survive. In January this year, Business Insider reported that Netflix shares soared to a 3-month high on the back of a bullish UBS report that featured a breakdown of some of the most central questions surrounding the streaming giant. Rebecca Ungarino for the Business Insider wrote a summary of 3 questions UBS analysts led by Eric Sheridan addressed. Question number 1. Will original content drive subscriber upside, especially in international markets? Sheridan and his team said they expect Netflix's original content slate to drive accelerating growth internationally, particularly with more local film and non-fiction content on the platform. They also contend there is still low broadband usage in growing markets like India, where Netflix could expand. Now, last month, Netflix said over 45 million accounts watched the Netflix original movie Bird Box in the first week it was released, a record, according to the company. And we now also know that 2 out of 3 viewers who watched Sacred Games, which though could be contended as a local show, were in fact outside of India. So there is scope for growth in international markets? That's the answer to question number one. Now, the second question, will increasing competition threaten Netflix's market share or pricing power? Now, UBS said it expected subscription streaming video will come to dominate TV over time, creating opportunities for multiple players and rising competition. Hulu and Amazon Prime are gaining market share in the streaming space. Still, the firm thinks, UBS that is, Netflix is well positioned because of its scale and slate of original content. That is also the driver behind their view that Netflix can still command pricing power or the ability to hold on to users while boosting prices. So yes, even if they were to increase the charges, and even if competition is abounding with excellent quality content out there, UBS believes that Netflix may still be ahead in the competition. And finally, question number three. How are subscribers tracking in the US and key overseas markets? The answer to that, domestic and international subscriber growth for the fourth quarter will likely come in strong, they said back then, given a few factors. Now, what are those factors? Application downloads, Google search trends for its original content, etc. Now, app tracking analysis suggests country share of downloads is tilting away from the US and toward international. Notably, Sheridan in the UBS report said growth in the US and more matured international markets appears to be plateauing, and that emerging markets in Latin America and Asia, particularly India, are the bright spots on local language content push. So what did I say about a year ago? I think I said on a podcast that if you don't go hyperlocal, you go home. So that is a model that Netflix and Amazon Prime and maybe Hulu in the future will all likely follow. According to the writer on Business Insider, more broadly, the firm outlined its long-term view that Netflix should achieve higher margins than Wall Street currently expects, as its content spend is now at a scale of the most major media companies.
The Deep Dive podcast series,
The Future of Netflix.
And there it is. Whether Spielberg and other naysayers like it or not, Netflix is now a major media company. It is also a television channel. That's how I prefer to see it. You go to that channel and there's a whole bunch of shows in a whole bunch of languages that you can sit and watch. And is it going anywhere based on what UBS had to say? Well, nowhere. And is it going to keep me surprised? Well, that's what they plan to do. And if they keep me surprised, I'm likely to stay on. Thank you for joining us. And if you want to tell us anything, do hesitate not to write to us on mcpodcast@nw18.com. Until the next time you hear from me, this is Mirakesh Sharma on behalf of the Money Control Podcast Desk saying thank you for joining us, and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.